everyone, and welcome back to Daniel. We are near the end of Daniel chapter 5. As you can see, the handwriting is on the wall. We've been joking about that all week. Okay, I believe we had gotten as far as Daniel 5:18 last time, so we'll be finishing up the worksheet on chapter 5 and then doing chapter 6. You'll want both of those. Chapter 7 is for next week. Let's begin with prayer. Lord Jesus, give us the courageous faith of Daniel when faced even with something like the lion's den. He showed trust in you. Help us to show trust as we face the metaphorical lions that we have living as your children in a hostile world. We ask for this gift in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, we are finishing up the account of the handwriting on the wall, chapter 5. On the back side of the sheet, we had gotten as far as Daniel 5, verse 18. While we're going, the sign-up sheet will go around soon. I'm going to pass around. I always do binders up for each one of my Bible classes, and I came across on the internet an interesting painting. We'll give you a little art appreciation today by Rubens of Daniel in the Lion's Den. So I'll just pass around so you can take a look at it. You'll remember that Belshazzar has been having a feast with the people of his empire when suddenly a hand appears and writes on the wall four mysterious words. And at first he's nonplussed. The queen, it seems to be the queen mother, comes and reminds him of Daniel, Daniel's ability to interpret dreams. And I believe the section that we're in is where Daniel begins to speak to King Belshazzar. Verse 18. O King, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the peoples and nations and men of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like cattle. And his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and sets over them anyone he wishes. But you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives and your concubines, drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. As far as we go in that section, let's take a look at the questions in the worksheet. How does Daniel begin his words to Belshazzar in verse 18? Can you pick up any simple tips from his first sentence on how to witness to people? I thought the wording was interesting. Paul?
With respect, he starts out, you know, giving the king the respect that's due him.
True.
Put him in that position. I'm going to respect that position no matter who's in it.
Very good. The person you address when you are witnessing is somebody who deserves respect. Even though you may have kind of, almost a prejudicial thoughts about them because you know they don't believe in God. they still, as a Christian, you should be giving them respect. Anything else? This sentence is worded in the way that an English teacher would tell you to word it. And that's part of the strength behind Daniel's approach. Linda?
I was going to say he states it as fact. Because here, everyone wants to get along and, my God's my God, your God's your God. It's okay as long as we get along. And here it's just the Most High God.
Yes. It's stated as a fact, right? There's no compromising about it. There's no maybe appeal that Daniel makes to the king, right? He simply states the fact. Does anybody know from your English classes what is the strongest way of making a statement? As far as like the verbs and getting into the grammar and that sort of thing. Anybody ever take creative writing?
Years ago.
Hands going up.
Well, do you remember things like your teacher saying, use active verbs, where you take a subject and you tell what that subject did, right? Let's analyze the grammar of it just a little bit for a moment. Verse 18, O King, the Most High God. Well, how much firmer could you start as far as subject goes, right? He starts with God and uses this name of God that has been used a lot in Daniel, right? That really exalts God. The Most High God gave your father, Nebuchadnezzar, notice the verb is what? Gave. This is a giving God. He's a good God. He has already done, and now he draws in the person who has been benefited by this God, right? Has given your father, Nebuchadnezzar, do you see the progression of the thought here? Starts with God, tells what God has done, and then, you promised me.
I didn't
and
do it.
And then draws in somebody who is near and dear to the recipient of the message, right? And then what comes after that? Gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. What would you say? Those are the direct objects of the verb, right? How would you characterize those words? Gifts, right? And wonderful gifts, right? Nebuchadnezzar has been very blessed by God. You see what I'm talking? I'm just trying to get the little nuances there so that you can begin to pepper your language in the same way when you're witnessing to someone. Don't start with, well, where are you at? Or, try to mold around them a message. Or even, who else is missing from the beginning of the sentence? Which is a key in understanding how to witness. Nothing about Daniel in the sentence, right? I think we are so prone to want to start with the person we're witnessing to, or start with, let me tell you what God has done for me. Now, obviously, God has done. It's good that you get it there in the sentence. But if you put yourself in the focal point of the beginning of your witness, or even put the other person in the focal point of your witness, they're going to expect, oh yeah, he wants to talk about me. She wants to talk about me. When the little grammatical signals will set the tone for, I'm going to talk about God here, right? Put God in the focal point. Anything else that you want, that you notice about how he begins? Laura?
Kind of reminded me of all the person who begins. Mm-hmm.
Reminded Laura of how Paul addressed the people of Athens. I don't happen to remember the beginning of that off the top of my head, but is there any part of it that you want to put?
No, just the respectfulness, not
the point. When Paul addressed the Athenians, remember, he gave them credit. Talked about how they were always looking for something new, the latest philosophies, and that sort of thing. So he treats them in a noble way as being seekers of knowledge, right? is in the same way that Daniel is showing respect to Belshazzar. Good. Anyone else? Norma? And especially in the first sentence, right? Notice how there's nothing negative about his father, Nebuchadnezzar, right? But he starts with the blessings. I believe it's very good to start with the gospel when witnessing. Even before you bring the law in. You're going to want to bring the law in when you witness to somebody, right? But it's not the thing you start with in most cases. Okay, excellent points. Let's go on. Verse 19. Daniel almost seems to say that all of Nebuchadnezzar's actions flowed out of his desires. What error in this type of thinking does he point out in verse 20? Did you notice how in that second verse, Daniel almost seems to be puffing Nebuchadnezzar up a little bit? Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. Those he wanted to humble, he humbled. It sounds like everything in the kingdom went according to what Nebuchadnezzar wanted. Mark.
Well, Nebuchadnezzar was an egomaniac. That guy thought he was the top of everything. He thought he created everything, he made everything. And what Danny points out is to say, his power came from God, and that's what happened. He kept on thinking, I can do it all. That's when God said, no, you can't. Without me, you're nothing. Here's what we're going to do for the next couple of years.
This is how Daniel brings in the law about Nebuchadnezzar, right? Nebuchadnezzar thought he could do whatever he wanted. But how did that type of thinking end in verse 20 for Nebuchadnezzar? This is review from last time.
Well, I was going to say he hardened his heart. Sin as the Pharaohs did. His heart got hardened by his arrogance.
Okay, his heart was hardened, although that's not what Daniel emphasized in chapter 4. What was the big thing that happened to Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4? When? Yes. Gave him insanity, right? Nebuchadnezzar is this egomaniac, and so God says, let's give him some mania, right? We'll make him a maniac. The punishment fit the crime, right? Mark.
I know this is kind of off track here a little bit because Michelle and I were gone on vacation, but I was really curious, when he was insane, where was he during that period of time?
It is a question that I can't, maybe if you stick around afterwards, let's talk further because we covered it while you were on vacation. Okay, anything else about this type of thinking? When human beings act like they are the center of the universe, God always brings them down, right? And God did it in a very gracious way to Nebuchadnezzar. It was a very extreme way, but there was no other way to get his attention. And the Lord caused him to be insane for what seems to have been a period of 7 years. Okay, next one. Again, what was God's purpose in humbling Nebuchadnezzar? According to verse 21. What was the purpose in it? David?
He wanted to force Nebuchadnezzar, just reading from the verse, mm-hmm. to acknowledge that the Most High God is sovereign over the kingdoms of men.
Yes. We get back to our theme of Daniel, right? That God is in control and not me. Not Nebuchadnezzar back in those days, not Daniel, not anyone, but God. This was God's way of teaching Nebuchadnezzar that God is in control of all things. Next one. What kinds of things are difficult to hand down from generation to generation? I worded that question the way I did because Daniel says to Belshazzar, but you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Why is it surprising that Belshazzar is now arrogant when his father had gotten his comeuppance? Rosemary. Wisdom is something you can't pass on. What else? There's another thing mentioned here. Humility, right? Humility is a lesson that every person has to learn on their own. I think sometimes we parents put too much pressure on ourselves when parenting our children. We think that we can teach our children the lessons, the life lessons that we learned through experience without them having to go through the same kinds of experiences. Don't you see that that's one of the biggest mistakes that's made in parenting today? There's a lot of talk about the generations, especially in our time, where, you know, the, what do they call, like, the Depression era or the World War II generation, and then the baby boomers who they parented. And I think most people who are now analyzing at this point in time say the biggest mistake was the older generation had to go through all of these difficulties of the Depression, of World War II, and they were foolish enough, I'll use the word, to think that they could spare their children all of that kind of suffering and that their children would turn out the same way as they did. That was a mistake on their part. It was a kindly thing they wanted to do for their children. But children can't learn things like a work ethic, or can't learn things like good manners, even, or you know, the values, the true inner character building type values, unless those children go through similar experiences. And so I just picked up a little bit in Daniel's wording about that. Though you knew these things, Belshazzar. Belshazzar no doubt knew how his father, though we looked last time, it's probably more likely that Nebuchadnezzar was his grandfather. He no doubt had heard the stories about how grandpa was insane for 7 years. But he himself did not learn the humility from grandpa's lessons. That's what I wanted to bring out in this particular question. Gwen?
I was just going to say, in this country, we just tend to think that each generation, things are going to get better and better because of the lessons learned. And I guess at some point in time, everything's going to be perfect. We know that's not what's going to happen.
It just doesn't work that way in this world, right? We have this idea that each generation can get better and better, and we set ourselves up for a bigger fall, I think.
In fact, it gets worse. Just like Belshazzar was worse than never. Yeah. I mean, things just got worse.
Yes. Yeah. It gets worse rather than better.
But, you know, if it would have been his father and he would have saw his father go through that, it would have been a little bit closer to home and he would have probably understood it a little bit better, although it wouldn't have changed him. Mm-hmm. But a grandfather, he didn't see any of that. He just heard it.
Probably shielded from it, even if he was alive at that time. Yeah. Okay, let's go on to the next question. How had Belshazzar's actions at the feast been an offense to God? Verse 23.
All blasphemy. Used the vessels from the temple to drink them, just in the face of God.
Yes.
He knew what those vessels were.
Yes.
And he went and got them and brought them in and drank out of them.
Paul calls it blasphemy. Belshazzar used those cups that Nebuchadnezzar had brought from the temple in Jerusalem, ones that were dedicated only for feasts that were served there in connection with the sacrifices, and he uses them for this drunken party that he has. And even the blasphemy goes one step further. What else is there in verse 23?
In other places, they praised gold, silver, and bronze.
Yeah, they were gold and silver goblets, and so he began to praise the gods of gold and silver. And then he went on and on to other substances that weren't there, right? And the gods of bronze, and the gods of wood, and the gods of earth, and true blasphemy, right? When these had belonged to the Lord in the temple. Anything else about his offense to God? Okay, then let's finish up the chapter, the interpretation of the writing. Verse 24. Therefore he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. This is the inscription that was written. And I put it up on the wall, so you can see the handwriting on the wall in Aramaic. Mene, it goes this way in Aramaic. Mene, mene, tekel, ufarsi. And it's all Greek to you, right? Verse 26, this is what these words mean. Mene. And you can see in your footnote too, hopefully that helped you as you were interpreting it. Down in the footnote, mene can mean numbered or mina. All of the words here have double meanings, which is why the people couldn't understand them when they appeared on the wall. It means numbered in the Aramaic language, but it also came to be a unit of gold or silver or whatever, precious substance, that became like a denomination of money, the mina. I'm sure you've heard that word in some of Jesus' parables. It was a typical form of a denomination of currency in Jesus' day also. And here's the interpretation that Daniel gives. God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. That one is doubled. It's said twice. Then comes tekel. You can look at your footnote again on it. Tekel can mean weighed. At first, they always weighed their money. It was not printed in uniform coins. That was a rather recent development that may not have even been around in Daniel's day yet. But rather, you had your bag of gold and you dumped it out on the scales, and then people weighed that money. So tekel means weighed, or in Hebrew, it came to be used as the word for their type of money, which is shekel. You can hear it in there, tekel, shekel. And that one, Daniel interprets this way, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. You've been weighed, but you don't weigh enough. There's something lacking in you, something wrong with you. And the final word is printed out Paris here. Look in your footnote again, Paris. The singular Parsin can mean divided, or Persia is the two meanings of this one. This one actually has three meanings, huh? Or it can mean half a mina or half a shekel. It's related to that first one, divided. And evidently, it really is a verb. And when it was used, sometimes it would be used for a divided part of money. When you're dividing out, okay, you take half and I'll take half. And each of those was the paris. You each get a paris out of it. Because paras in Aramaic means divide. Linda.
As I was studying this, I wondered, is there any reason why the name was said twice?
I don't know. The commentators that I read didn't comment on it. Yeah. And it didn't come up in my mind. Did you do any thinking on it or find anything about it? Yeah.
But I didn't know if there was actually a reason, like linguistically, if it does something.
No, I can't think of anything, but I would say similar to what you do with your kids. You repeat, and it lends a certain rhythm to it, right? Number. Greg.
On the cross, Jesus said, my God, my God.
Yeah. The first word, because my God in Aramaic is all one word. So he repeated the first word. It may have been a typical way of speaking in the language. Okay, and I didn't look at, going back up to verse 28 there, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Daniel 2 was seeing the play on words. This word actually means divided or half. But it just, by chance, sounds almost exactly the same as the word Persian does in Aramaic. So there was like a hint or a foreshadowing or an overtone about the Persians in the message, even though the literal interpretation of it doesn't say anything about Persia. But it's interesting that the fourth word is that close to Persian. Let's finish off this section, 29. Then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple. A gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. Okay, our questions in the worksheet in connection with this section. Using the footnotes on verses 26 through 28, as well as the text itself, write down the meaning of the four words written on the wall. Well, we've already worked through that, right? And evidently, it's because it was a generic enough phrase that Belshazzar didn't recognize right away what its meaning was. I mean, if you just listen to it one more time. Numbered, numbered, weighed, and divided. Well, what does that mean? Daniel had to give the specific interpretation of it, right? The days of your kingdom are numbered. You have been weighed and found wanting. Your kingdom is going to be divided. Paul.
I think it's interesting to note that it's in Arabic, which is their main language, which the people should have been able to interpret.
Yes.
That God used Arabic, yet God...
Aramaic. Not Arabic.
But God also closed the minds of those people, so his sovereignty again comes out.
Mm-hmm.
That here, this handwriting is in your language.
True.
That you can't understand it.
Yes.
But I'll tell you what it means.
Good point.
Yeah.
It's written in their own language. The people there at the banquet should have been able to understand it. But again, God is showing his sovereignty, as so often in the book of Daniel. Even though I show you in your own language, it doesn't sink in until my interpreter comes, my Daniel, who you keep ignoring every time you have a dream, and he will interpret my word to you. Good point. Louisa? As a way to get out of it?
Yeah.
Well, that had been the promise, remember, from the beginning, that whoever interpreted would be made third highest. And Daniel had actually declined that when he first came to give the interpretation. But for some reason, he allows Belshazzar to give it to him anyway. So Belshazzar is just carrying through on his word. And also then, remember, that very night, Cyrus the Persian comes into Babylon, conquers it. It's rather sketchily worded there at the end, but that's the reason why Belshazzar dies that night. Because the Persians invade Babylon that very night and conquer it. The message comes true very quickly. Anything else about the message of the handwriting on the wall? Then our last question there, this is a big question for anyone who studies Daniel. Using Bible helps find out who Darius the Mede was. What did you find about this mysterious character? Martha?
It was interesting. I found that he isn't mentioned in any text outside of the Bible, so there's a question.
This is one of the facts of Daniel that causes the Bible skeptics to get really active. Aha! Look at here. History does not mention a Darius the Mede. There were Dariuses who came up later who were emperors in the Persian Empire. But at this time, there was no one called Darius. Now, Bible students will always say, well, just because other documents don't mention these guys does not mean that they never existed. That's the famous argument from silence, which is a very dangerous argument, really, to make. Our ancient documents are very sketchy. We do not have, you know, we think of, like, what do they do in Congress, where they take minutes of the entire session, and you can go back and look years back what happened on a certain day in Congress. Well, we certainly don't have details like that for all of ancient history. And there certainly could be a Darius the Mede. So we stick by our inspired scriptures and say, yes, there was a Darius that no one else mentioned. Did you find any other theories of who this Darius could be in your study? Joyce. As a matter of fact, I think he was definitely appointed, right, in history. This man by the name of Gubaru was appointed by Cyrus the Persian, who was the emperor who conquered Babylon. He put this governor, Gubaru, in charge of Babylon. And it may be this man that for some reason has the name Darius among us. In the commentary I was reading, this Gubaru, that's how it was said in his language, but the Greeks pronounced it Gubrias. And I thought, well, that's getting closer to Darius at least. Perhaps the words could be similar in one of the ancient languages.
I thought it'd be interesting if most Bible scholars say Darius and Cyrus are the same person.
That's the other theory. That Cyrus himself was known by another name, which seems to have been quite common in the ancient world, and perhaps this Darius the Mede is the same person as Cyrus, that was his other name. Anybody find anything else out about Darius? Betty?
It just says in the footnotes here that Cyrus was his throne name.
Yes. Cyrus's throne name there in Babylon was Darius. That's what the NIV self-study Bible says about it. Martha?
I was just wondering what language was Cyrus or Darius. What language
was Cyrus would be, I'm assuming, I'd probably better check back to look at that, but since he's Persian, it would be the Persian language, Parsi. Yes. Wayne?
Yeah, on a Google, I picked up it was only mentioned once. It said when Egypt fell to the Persians in the late 16th century, Cyprus was made part of satrapy of King Darius. That's the only thing I could find.
Would you say it again? I couldn't follow.
Okay, when Egypt fell to the Persians in the late 6th century, Cyprus was made part of the satrapy of King Darius.
Oh. And this is Cyprus with a P, right? Not
right.
Cyrus, but Cyprus, which would be the island of Cyprus. So evidently Google was aware of some historical mention of a Darius who was over a satrapy. Okay, I was not aware of that. I from everything I read, it said none of the secular history mentioned Darius. So that could be then, if you could trace back the source of that, would be an evidence of a Darius living at this time. Anything else on Darius the Mede? Okay, then let's move on from our handwriting on the wall to the lion's den. We're in some interesting chapters of Daniel here. Our first section that you were asked to read on Monday was Daniel 6, 1 to 5. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs. But they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God." That was the first section you were asked to read this week. Let's take a look at the questions. What is perhaps surprising and yet not surprising about the fact that Daniel was appointed as one of only three administrators over the new Medo-Persian Empire? There's a whole new empire come into effect here now through the conquering of Babylon, and it was made up of two main tribes, the Medes and the Persians, so sometimes it's referred to as the Medo-Persian Empire. Surprising, not surprising. Penny?
What surprised me is that he was made
Daniel has been made the third in charge. Now, you've got to remember, of the Babylonian kingdom. But still, he's a thing that would have been in Daniel's favor is he was not a Babylonian, right? He was in the Babylonian government, but he was Jewish. And so it's a little surprising, maybe not surprising, that he's put in charge. Anyone else? Wayne?
Didn't his dad pave the way?
Who's dad?
Nebuchadnezzar. He paved the way.
True, but you've got to remember now that Darius is from a whole other country who has invaded the Babylonians, killed off their previous king, Belshazzar, and is starting a whole new administration. Right? Go ahead. By this time, Daniel is quite old. Remember, at the end of the lesson last time, we said this happened in 539 BC, and we first saw Daniel in 605 BC. So he's already had a career of 65 years about, and so he's got to be up there at least 80 years old by this time, right? But evidently he had a reputation, Gwen says, that when the new administration comes in, they put him as one of the three top men over the whole new Persian Empire.
Well, could it be as simple as that he was Jewish and he wasn't really one of them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was mentioning before. The fact that he was Jewish and he was not Babylonian may have stood him in good stead. Anything else? Surprising or not surprising?
Well, I think it's not surprising. Maybe they heard that he...
So that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines,
they were going to be the new empire.
He interpreted the message, right? And did the Persians hear this and say, perhaps Daniel is on our side? Linda.
Well, and if he did have a reputation, that would be surprising because he's the one always giving bad news.
Yes.
I mean, you're going to be insane, you're going to die.
That's right. This is surprising, right? Because whenever he has a message, he brings bad news. Anything else?
And I think it's important that, again, God had more work for him to do.
Yes.
He was going to be used by God, and we'll see coming up, but because the Jewish people were still in exile.
Yes. It should not be surprising to us as believers, because this is how God carries out his plan, right? He was God's chosen one to be the messenger throughout this. B. He had a lot of experience, yes. And he must have been very gifted, right? We said it really was no surprise that Nebuchadnezzar chose him, even though he came from a foreign culture. Because these kings wanted to get people from all over their empire to be influential because that was their way of consolidating their power, right? Well, the new administration, if you're trying to swallow, if you're this big anaconda coming from Iran and you want to swallow up Babylon, well, you're going to have to take a lot of their key people in order to keep it all together, right? Beth, you had a thought too.
Well, going with what Linda said, he always brought the bad news, but it always came true.
Yes. But it always came true when he had the news. Exactly. He did it without self-interest. Wait.
Yeah, Daniel worked more efficiently and capable than all the rest. Thus, he attracted the attention of the pagan king.
Yeah, the work ethic, right? He did his work well. Not only was he gifted, but he stuck to the task. And is able to impress the Persians very quickly with his ability.
I don't know if we said this yet, but he predicted the fall of Babylon, so they want him there.
Yeah, and we did mention that he predicted the fall of Babylon. Let's go on to number two. How is Daniel a role model for Christians in how they can serve when it comes to this earthly life? In verse 3. Wait.
Stand tall.
Stand tall, right? Yes. Do your work well. Don't cower in the corner somewhere. Don't hide yourself away. But let the blessings that God has given you, let them shine through you.
Martha, well, don't put yourself first.
And don't put yourself first. And he always waited for them to come to him for an interpretation, right? He was not bossy or egotistical. Louisa. Fourth commandment, the only commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on the earth, right? When we obey authority. Good points. Third one, what reaction can believers expect from the world as we go about doing our work well? Greg.
Perhaps envy, jealousy, plotting.
Yes.
Negative.
All the things that we see here with the other administrators, right? And the other satraps, they're jealous of Daniel, right? And even things like plotting, Greg points out. It's connected with our last one. For that day. How does the world like to go for the jugular when opposing Christians? What did you see in verse 5? They like to go for our religion, right? Well, I can't find anything else wrong with them, so let's get at this religious thing. Let's pick at the faith a little bit. Isn't it similar to what happens today? David?
I think it's interesting, too, that these people make the same mistake that a lot of people make. They think by attacking my religion or Daniel's religion, they're attacking me. They're attacking God.
Yeah.
And they don't get it, you know? And exactly. So in Daniel's time, it's God who responds.
Yes. Yeah. We take it personally. Oh, they're attacking me. Well, it's not always me they're attacking. If they go for my faith, it's really God that they're attacking, right? And so God answers. Daniel doesn't have to personally answer for it.
And I think that we need to learn that lesson today, because I think sometimes when we're attacked, we do take it personally. We take up God's offenses when we're like, we should just like Daniel go, hey, you need to talk to the big guy. It's his deal. It's not me. And I think that we as Christians get a bad rap sometimes because we try and talk for God instead of letting God talk.
Yes. How often haven't we asked the question, well, why didn't Daniel speak up when they said things like, he is filled with the spirit of the gods, right? Evidently, that wasn't a time where God said, okay, now I want you to take this message to the people, right? So he was the type of person who was calm at times of when his faith was being put in the spot, right?
I wonder how many of us could stand up with Daniel, because they couldn't find any fault with Daniel, the administrator of the satraps. They could find fault with me, and I don't know, maybe I'm the only one here, but I think that's another thing. You know, yes, they go for the jugular by attacking our faith, but one of the things I think that we give them, because we're at the same time saints and sinners, and they don't understand that, the world attacks us and say, well, I saw you speeding, or I saw you doing this, and so you're just a hypocrite.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think we all give the world too much ammunition as compared to what Daniel gave the world, right?
They didn't have cars then.
Well, he could have driven his chariot too fast.
I think it's a real compliment to Daniel that they had to actually create a situation to attract him.
Yes.
You know, they had to create it because there wasn't.
What a compliment to Daniel, right? That his enemies had to create a trap for him in order to try to catch him. All of the intrigue that goes on with making this law, laws of the Medes and the Persians, and lion's den and everything. That's a compliment to Daniel, isn't it? That they couldn't find anything on him. He's going to say at the end of it, I was found innocent. I didn't hurt you, King, in any way, nor did I offend God in any way.
A lot of parallelism to Christ.
Yeah. Parallelism to Christ, right? Foreshadowing. Joseph, we've often looked at the Joseph story, and that's a similar one. Where Joseph, we know he's a sinner, just like we know Daniel was a sinner. And yet their foibles are not portrayed in the books, right? Okay, let's go on to the next section, verse 6. So the administrators and the satraps went as a group to the king and said, O King Darius, live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or man during the next 30 days, except to you, O king, should be thrown into the lion's den. Now, O king, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered, in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. So Darius put the decree in writing. Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. First question in connection with that section. We have discussed the polytheism, belief in many gods, of the ancient Babylonians in our class already. What other type of religious belief common among many ancient peoples now plays into the events of Daniel in verse 7? Why would a king be willing to accept such a suggestion? What is the new thing, Louisa? That the king is a god. This was common in these ancient Middle Eastern empires that the king was a god, but this is the first time it comes up here. And what about the second question? Why would a king be willing to adopt such a suggestion? Oh, I'm so high up there, right? I'm in control of the entire world. Well, why not, maybe? What a great suggestion. It played to his ego, right? Good.
There's the possibility that Darius was actually a governor/regent under Cyrus.
Yes, if Darius really is a second fiddle, boy, then it would be really attractive, huh? Oh, I'm sure they're going to make Cyrus into a god, but me too? Okay, going on to the next one. Using Bible helps, find out what you can about the laws of the Medes and the Persians. Why would the king's advisors want to use this type of law in order to bring Daniel down? Could you find anything about the laws of the Medes and the Persians? Paul.
Well, when a law is made, even a king can't change it.
Yes.
That's the biggest thing. Can't make the change once it's signed.
The uniqueness of this type of law is that once it was made, it could not be repealed. It could not be changed.
What? Kings didn't make the laws.
No, that's why they went to the king, because the king had to make the law.
Oh, okay.
But once he made a law, then it could not be repealed. In my study during the week, I came across one where there was a Persian emperor who sentenced someone to death and realized before the sentence was carried out that the guy was innocent and he could do nothing about it. In this ancient document, he words his sorrow over this guy, and not just the guy, but his family was also put to death for the crime. So it seems, you know, like later on in the story, that's going to happen because that was a Persian custom, that if somebody was sentenced to death, their entire family was killed with them.
That also happened in the book of Esther, which makes me wonder, where's Esther fit in Daniel, after, during, or?
I believe Esther is after. She was in Susa, huh? Right in Persia itself. And the king at the time was King Xerxes. And Xerxes followed Cyrus. So Esther has to come afterwards. But Esther is another biblical book that brings this up twice about laws of the Medes and Persians being ones that can't be repealed. Wayne?
Yeah, she beat me to it. It was the verse 119. It said, therefore, and this is in Esther, therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media. Which cannot be repealed.
Same wording in Esther chapter 1.
I think the thing that got me was if judgment and sentence was the same day. Mm. You were judged and sentenced the same day. There's no appealing, there's no nothing, you're done.
Yes. Swift justice, right? When you don't have something like a democracy where everything has checks and balances, right? Justice is very swift. Let's go on to the next one. List the various details of how Daniel went about his prayer that made it obvious he was doing this in response to the decree. What can you learn for your faith life from Daniel's actions? What are the details of what he does? Ellie? As soon as he hears the decree, he goes to pray, and how does he pray? Doesn't do it in secret, opens the windows for Jerusalem, which was his custom of how to pray, longing to get back to the land that God had given to his ancestors, and other details?
Upstairs window.
Upstairs window. Right? Easily seen up there. What else? Three times a day, he stays in his normal routine like he's been doing. Any other little details? Joyce?
Giving thanks to his God.
Thanking God even at a time like this when he could be wringing his hands and, oh my goodness, because of this, I'm going to get thrown into the lion's den, right? He prays with thanksgiving at a time like this. The only other little detail I noticed was getting down on his knees. Showing the humility, still realizing our theme of Daniel so far, that God is in control, that God is almighty, and I bow to him alone. Okay, next section. Verse 11. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or man, except to you, O king, would be thrown into the lion's den? The king answered, the decree stands in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. Then they said to the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day. When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Then the men went as a group to the king and said to him, Remember, O king, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you. Let's consider the questions in connection with that. Top of the next page. Don't the ulterior motives of the advisors seem obvious? Wouldn't the king see through their intrigue? Why would he go along with such personal agendas?
That's no choice.
Now his back is up against the wall, right?
That's no choice.
He's already made the law. There really is nothing he can do, and he knows that from his own culture. Any other thoughts about what's going on in the king's mind?
I think he probably feels really duped that he didn't see this before. You know, and he's really feeling guilty that he allowed his ego to get the best of him.
Feeling duped, feeling guilty that he let his ego get the best of him. I would think that it's a feeling that's not uncommon when you're up there in government. Because in order to have power, you always have to make these coalitions with various groups to keep them happy. And perhaps since he's new on the scene, coming as a Persian and trying to get all these advisors on one page, he realized maybe one of his first times where he stepped into something that is a mistake that should never have happened, and he feels really bound, really tied. Let's go on to the set. Oh, David, did you have one?
I just wanted to agree with you, Pastor, and also to think, you know, Daniel is valuable to him because Daniel is a great administrator.
Yes.
And he relies on all of his administrators.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's been duped.
Yes.
Because they're plotting against each other and he didn't know.
Yeah, there's infighting now with one of his prized people,
yeah.
Right? And he's very drawn to Daniel already. Second question. Why do you think the king seems so concerned about rescuing Daniel from his own decree? Kind of pursuing David's thought further.
Daniel is not disloyal.
He knew of about the objectivity that Daniel has been showing all along. He knows from his reputation and that sort of thing. And so he's drawn to Daniel. This is the kind of man who's going to be a strength in my government, right?
Yeah, he was the best advisor he had, and he knew it. You know, he's the most faithful.
Yes. And I wonder, too, on top of what everything that you guys are saying, whether there wasn't just a personal rapport already that had built between the king and Daniel. Let's finish this section, and then we'll pick it up there next time. Why would the king have confidence in Daniel's God to rescue him? His final comment is simply, I'm commending you over to your God. Why would a heathen king like this, who comes from Persia, remember, and hasn't had a hand in all the other miracles that have happened, hasn't seen the witness of the interpretation of the dreams and the fiery furnace and everything, why would this king commend Daniel into the hand of his God?
Perhaps they recognize that such a person that is so highly respected and has such gifts is looked favorably upon.
Yes. I think Daniel has witnessed well to these people, right? So that this king has the confidence to say, may your God keep you safe, Daniel. It's almost an admission already by Darius that he's not in control of everything, right? He's saying to Daniel, I can't help you in this situation. Now, may your God protect you. It speaks well again of Daniel and his witness and his faith, right? Friend.
Wouldn't have, even though he was so from so far away, wouldn't have he heard about the other miracles in the fiery furnace? I mean, that kind of thing, you don't just stick in one little corner.
It could be that Darius had heard about these things, but one thing I would say in our previous chapter, remember that Belshazzar had to be reminded of them. So we had said a long period of time had come. What was it, at least 25 years since the fiery furnace or any of the dream interpretations? So, I don't know. It could be, Fran. I wouldn't rule it out.
But Darius was a heathen. Even in their religion, they believe that God intervened. A God intervenes.
Yes.
In their heathen religion, they believe.
Yes. So that may be part of his comment, too. Just his, he knows that your God will protect you where you are, and your God will protect you. So, well, may your God protect you. It may just be a superstitious comment on his part, right? Okay, our time is up. The bell rang already. Let's pick it up there at the Thursday section, Daniel 6:17 next time, and pick up a worksheet for chapter 7.
Okay, so where'd he go?